Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone, to the third meeting of the 2007 Spring Speaker Series here at WNL. I'm Frank Grizzard, director of the Lee Family Digital Archive, who is co-sponsoring the event along with the WNL History Department and the Lee Chapel and Museum. I appreciate you coming. I see some of you have come before, and there's some younger people in the crowd, too, this time, so I guess Holt must have leaned on his students a little bit. We'll know who gets A's and B's and C's in the upcoming end of the semester. It's a beautiful day, so I know the challenges of getting here. I had to face the same challenges that you did, so I really do, again, appreciate your coming. We're privileged to have local, well, I guess he's not local here. He's not local. He's local to me because I lived in Charlottesville for about 20 years and got to know Rick Britton there very well, so I always call him local, thinking about where I was at. Rick is a Charlottesville-based writer, historian, cartographer. His maps appear in many editions of collected works of modern scholarly papers, for instance, George Washington papers. Rick has written over 200 articles that goes in magazines, periodicals, newspapers. He also has a radio career, a television career. I just don't know how one person has squeezed so much into one lifetime and to be as young as he is. He's got some books out. One is Albemarle to Charlottesville, an Illustrated History, which unfortunately we couldn't bring here because it's out of print. It's being reprinted right now. There are some other books unrelated to Rick's talk, though, and we welcome you to purchase them. All the proceeds go to the Lee Chapel. He's also got a new book, Jefferson and a Monticello Sampler, published by Mariner Press right here across the way in Buena Vista. And it's a series of essays and articles that Rick had published in Albemarle and other magazines over the years related strictly to Jefferson and Monticello, which has nothing to do, again, with Robert E. Lee, the reason he's here today. Rick has done some extensive work, though, in Robert E. Lee, the career of Robert E. Lee up to the war. And many people don't know it. Lee spent 24 years as an engineer. That's what his career was. It was not as a general. He will get into that, tell us more than we can absorb in an hour, and at the end you can ask questions. Do want to remind you, next week we have Mary Cowling, who is a local author, coming to speak on the women in Lee's life, the author of The Lee Girls, and we're going to have a reception beforehand at the Reeves Center up the hill here. If you would like to come, we still have a couple of more openings. It's almost filled up. You do need to reserve in advance. It'll be for an hour at 3 o'clock. From 3 to 4, then we'll move down here. So it's a good time to get to see some of the items that are in the Lee Memorial Chapel Museum downstairs that are not available right now. You can see them up close and in a different setting while the museum is being renovated here. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rick Britton, and let's make him welcome.
Thanks, Frank, so much. Frank told me he was going to do a short introduction. That was a big introduction. If you don't mind, I'm going to take my jacket off. Feels more like May today, doesn't it? I have to tell you what an honor it is for me to be here and to talk about the man, particularly in this environment. Frank also told me I need to put this on. Testing. Is that good? Okay. Just want to correct Frank. Robert E. Lee was an engineer for actually 27 years of his life, not 24. Let's take a look at this real quick. Here's an image of Lee. I know y'all have seen this before, but it pertains directly to what I'll be talking about today, because this is Lee during the time that he was assigned out west. Of course, it was done here back east, but it's during the very period during which I'll be talking about Lee. Also wanted to give you an idea of the size of St. Louis at the time that I'm talking about it. I didn't realize before researching this piece how large a place St. Louis was in 1835 and the 1830s. And then last but certainly not least, you won't be able to understand what I'm talking about in the harbor at St. Louis without taking a look at this map. And maybe you'll recognize it, but this was done by Douglas Southall Freeman's fantastic biography of Robert E. Lee, Volume 1. The old steamboat sat alongside the rapids, perched atop the river rocks that had stoved in her thin hull. The lower deck was partly submerged, but her upper cabin deck, along with its staterooms, was dry and habitable. Yawning holes in the steamer's flooring, holes through which the engines had been hoisted, gave notice of her recent abandonment, and perhaps served as a reminder that her predicament along this treacherous stretch of the Mississippi River was not unique. While members of the surveying party fished from the stern for pike and blue catfish, their leader, a 30-year-old lieutenant of engineers, composed a letter on one of the stranded ship's few remaining tables. "I assure you we were not modest," he wrote to a fellow engineer of his appropriation of this vessel, "and we helped ourselves to everything that came our way. I need not tell you what a beautiful country it is, and I think at some time, some future day, must be a great one. You would scarcely recognize it. Villages have sprung up everywhere, and some quite pretty ones, too. Some 10 years hence, many will have grown into cities. The formation of a good channel through these rapids will be of immense advantage to the country, and great anxiety seems to be felt on this subject." The date was October 11, 1837, the site, a section of the Mississippi's upper rapids near the mouth of the Rock River. The letter writer, of course, was Robert E. Lee, and this letter in particular to Andrew Talcott would prove prophetic. Many of the river towns indeed grew into cities, for the coming decade of the 1840s would feature a massive boom in Mississippi-born commerce. Commercial tonnage transported on the upper Mississippi, in fact, tripled in the 10 years following 1839. Many would later claim that the Virginia engineers' work on the river played a significant role in that growth. Robert E. Lee is best remembered, of course, as the commander of the Confederacy's premier fighting force, the Army of Northern Virginia. At the helm of the ANV for almost 3 years, he not only turned back several federal attempts at Richmond, but also launched two invasions of the North. Lee's performance during the May of 1863 Chancellorsville campaign, despite being outnumbered 2-1, is still studied as a masterpiece of military science. He is also well remembered for the position he accepted after the war. As president of Washington College, Lee set the standard for the South in terms of acquiescence to the conflict's outcome and reconciliation between the previously warring sections. By comparison, however, little is remembered of Lee's first profession, that to which he devoted the most years of his life, engineering. Perhaps his finest efforts in the Army Corps of Engineers were those directed towards improving navigation on the Father of Waters, the Mississippi River. Born at Stratford Hall in Westmoreland County on January 19, 1807, Robert E. Lee was homeschooled until he was 13. At that age, he entered the Alexandria Academy and came under the tutelage of William B. Leary, an Irishman who for the next 3 years provided the young Virginian with a rudimentary classical education. "In mathematics he shone," wrote biographer Douglas Southall Freeman, "for his mind was already of the type that delighted in precise reasoning of algebra and geometry." Seeking to further his education but not wanting to burden his mother with the expenses, Lee then sought an appointment to the United States Military Academy. With the endorsement of 5 U.S. senators and 3 representatives to his favor, as well as, of course, the military reputation of his father, General Henry Light Horse Harry Lee, Robert E. Lee was appointed to West Point in March of 1824. The War Department letter, however, signed by then-Secretary John C. Calhoun, notified him that because of the large number of applicants, he could not be admitted until July of the following year. In order to avoid getting rusty, Lee studied mathematics during the intervening period under Benjamin Halliwell, the headmaster of a new boys' school in Alexandria, Virginia. "He was a most exemplary pupil in every respect," Halliwell wrote years later. "His specialty was finishing up. He imparted a finish and a neatness as he proceeded to everything he undertook. One of the branches of mathematics he studied with me was conic sections, in which some of the diagrams are very complicated. He drew the diagrams on a slate, and although he well knew that the one he was drawing would have to be removed to make room for another, he drew each one with as much accuracy and finish, lettering and all, as if it were to be engraved and printed." Robert E. Lee arrived at West Point in June of 1825. 37 miles up the Hudson from New York City, the United States Military Academy then consisted of but a handful of fairly plain structures arranged upon a commanding plateau 190 feet above the river. Historian Emory Thomas has called the institution a military monastery, a single-sex community of vigorous study, rigid discipline, and Spartan living. But it was so much more. The Academy was the first, and at the time, the finest engineering school in the United States, the special province of the Army Corps of Engineers. The two, in fact, were inseparable, having been simultaneously created by an 1802 Act of Congress which read that the Corps, quote, shall be stationed at West Point and shall constitute a military academy, unquote. The Act also stipulated that the Army's principal engineer would be West Point's superintendent. During the demanding four-year course of study, Robert E. Lee proved that diligence and self-control were his in abundance. Early on, he displayed a special proficiency in mathematics. In his second year, in fact, he was made an acting assistant professor of that subject and spent many long hours tutoring those cadets who were still struggling with it. Mathematics, naturally, was at the heart of the West Point curriculum and formed the foundation for the many courses in engineering and the sciences. At the Academy, Lee studied, among other subjects, chemistry, physics, optics, mineralogy, and astronomy. The courses on advanced mathematics covered trigonometry, calculus, analytical and descriptive geometry, and those pesky conic sections. One of the math textbooks, by the way, was Treatise on Descriptive Geometry and Conic Sections by French engineer Claudius Crozet, one of the founders of the Virginia Military Institute. The final term at West Point featured an intense focus on engineering. The comprehensive course was divided into five sections: field and permanent fortifications, the science of artillery, grand tactics, and civic and military architecture. This last topic covered drafting, the various orders of architecture, the design and construction of arches, bridges, buildings, canals, and other public works, and a detailed description of the machines used in that construction. In this subject, Lee found especial satisfaction, wrote Freeman, as among the sciences, the applied meant more to him than the theoretical. Robert E. Lee graduated second in the class of 1829 without incurring a single demerit, and that's pretty amazing, and exercising the right accorded class leaders, asked to be assigned to the engineers. Because engineering had fascinated him more than any other subject at the Academy, it would now become his profession. Thanks to his hard work, Lee was commissioned a brevet second lieutenant in the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army wasted no time in putting the 22-year-old to work. In August of 1829, Robert E. Lee was posted to Cockspur Island in the Savannah River, 12 miles downstream from the port city of Savannah. There he helped prepare for the construction of a large earthwork, eventually named Fort Pulaski, which would command the river. Lee remained at Cockspur for the 1829 and 1830 work sessions, seasons, spending much of his time, legend has it, armpit deep in the muddy Savannah River. His final months there, he was under the command of Lieutenant Joseph Mansfield, who was later killed at the Battle of Sharpsburg, leading a Union Army Corps. Lee was next assigned to Fortress Monroe in Virginia. Located on Old Point Comfort, a narrow spit of land forming the extreme tip of the peninsula between the James and the York Rivers, it had been the site of a military work since 1609. Lee reported for duty there in May of 1831. The following month, furlough in hand, Lee was married to Mary Ann Randolph Custis at Arlington, returning to Fort Monroe with his bride, but a few weeks prior to the slave insurrection led by Nat Turner. Lee went to work as assistant to Captain Andrew Talcott, the post's constructing engineer. The fort was nearly complete, but the outworks and moat still needed a bit of attention. Additionally, Lee supervised work on Fort Calhoun, a steadily sinking mound of stone just offshore. During his three-year stay on the Virginia Peninsula, he designed buildings, wharves, and fortifications, oversaw the preparation of accounts and reports, learned how to deal with laborers, civilian and military, and gained a great deal of experience in estimating construction costs. He had arrived with but limited experience. He was now completely qualified to independently direct a large engineering project. Unfortunately, the Corps of Engineers had other plans. Far from receiving an independent project, Lee was instead ordered to Washington, D.C. In November of 1834, he reported for duty in the capital city as assistant to the Army's chief engineer, Brigadier General Charles Grashot. Initially excited about the assignment, he quickly discovered that the office work was sheer drudgery, a daily shuffling of accounts, budgets, queries, clarifications, complaints, reports, vouchers. On the plus side, Lee was in charge of the office whenever the general was away, which was frequently, and because of the proximity to Arlington, he could ride to work and back across the Potomac. Despite one shining moment, however, a summer of 1835 assignment surveying the Ohio-Michigan border, Lee became extremely frustrated with his position as well as with the Corps itself. "You ask, what are my prospects in the Corps?" he wrote to Andrew Talcott on February 2, 1837. "Bad enough, unless the Corps is increased and something done for us. As to what I intend doing, it is rather hard to answer. There is one thing certain, I must get away from here. I am waiting, looking, and hoping for some good opportunity to bid an affectionate farewell to my dear Uncle Sam. And I seem to think that said opportunity is to drop in my lap like a ripe pear." Luckily for Lee and Uncle Sam, that pear had just ripened. The independent assignment Lee longed for lay out west on the mighty Mississippi. In the 1830s, the railroads had yet to conquer the west. The region's rivers, therefore, still served as its principal highways. Only 30-some years had passed since the Louisiana Purchase, however, and commerce along the upper section of the Mississippi River was just getting up ahead of steam. St. Louis had welcomed its first steamboat in 1817, but it was underpowered. Steamboats with more horsepower began plying the Father of Waters in the 1830s, but the upper Mississippi, the portion above the mouth of the Ohio, posed several significant navigational problems. Specifically, two long sets of dangerous rapids were forcing vessels at times of low water to lighten their loads and reduce their draft before attempting passage. Many steamers, despite this measure, were still being lost to the rocks. One of the rapids, 11 miles long, was upstream from where the Des Moines River empties into the Mississippi near Keokuk, Iowa. The other, a 15-mile white knuckler, lay just above the mouth of the Rock River at Rock Island, Illinois. There was another entirely different problem at St. Louis. Founded by the French in the 1760s on the Mississippi's right bank, where a 40-foot-high limestone bluff commands the water, St. Louis had boasted over 14,000 residents in the census of 1830. River commerce was its lifeblood. The city's entire riverfront, in fact, was one continuous bustling wharf. By the 1830s, however, that harbor was endangered. The very real possibility existed that St. Louis would become landlocked. Just opposite the city, and here you want to take a look at that map that appeared in Freeman. Just opposite the city, a large sand and silt island had grown in the Mississippi River, over a mile in length, 500 yards wide, and thick with cottonwood trees. It was known as Bloody Island because of the large number of duels being fought there. In 1830, for example, Major Thomas Biddle had faced off against the Honorable Spencer Pettus, a Missouri member of the 21st Congress, after being infuriated over charges Pettus had made against Biddle's brother, Nicholas Biddle, president of the Bank of the United States. On August 27th of 1830, the two met on Bloody Island, beyond the jurisdiction of the local authorities. That's the important thing, away from the sheriffs. Both, unfortunately, were mortally wounded at the first exchange. The problem with the island, of course, was not the affairs of honor being settled there. By the early 1830s, the Mississippi's current was beginning to cut along the eastern or Illinois side of the island, and during any major flood season, the Mercurial River might shift its main channel in that direction. Additionally, as the river in front of the city slowed and shallowed, another large sandbar, Duncan's Island, just as big as its bloody brother, was building up below the harbor and fast approaching. When these two land masses merged, St. Louis would be stranded about a mile away from its livelihood. That just wouldn't do, of course. In 1833, city leaders had paid John Goodfellow almost $3,000 to plow up the islands. It was thought that the river, when high, would wash away the loosened sand. When that plan failed, the mayor wrote to the House Committee on Roads and Canals asking for assistance from the federal government. 3 years later, in 1836, Congress appropriated first $15,000 and then an additional $50,000 to solve the growing problems at St. Louis. That year, too, Robert E. Lee's superior, General Charles Grashot, a proud native of St. Louis, and one of four Louisiana Territory boys appointed to West Point by President Thomas Jefferson, spent several weeks personally examining the river. Grashot believed that the Army Corps of Engineers could solve the problems along the upper Mississippi, the rapids, as well as the islands at St. Louis, and first assigned the task to Captain Henry Shreve. Shreve, who had made a name for himself by developing a steam-powered snag boat, was extremely busy, however, clearing the western waters. Grashot then remembered that back east, at Corps headquarters, his assistant was not only very capable, but very eager to get out into the field. Lee's orders for this, his first independent assignment, were dated April 6, 1837. Because his wife was expecting a baby, however, their third, he did not depart until mid-June. From Arlington, Lee, now a first lieutenant, journeyed to Philadelphia to purchase the necessary surveying equipment, then by way of the Pennsylvania Canal to Pittsburgh, where he boarded a steamer and descended the Ohio to Louisville. His traveling companion and assistant for this engineering project was Second Lieutenant Montgomery C. Meigs, but 1 year out of West Point. Sound familiar? A native of Georgia, Meigs later served as Quartermaster General of the Federal Army during the Civil War. At Louisville, Lee met up with Captain Shreve and inspected the equipment the experienced engineer had ordered for improving the rapids. This included two machine boats, especially designed for raising submerged rocks, and an open barge in which to transport them. These were not quite completed, so Lee directed that they follow him to St. Louis. At Louisville, too, First Lieutenant Lee, according to Meigs, organized and outfitted a strong surveying party of rivermen. Arriving at St. Louis on August 5, 1837, Lee and Meigs took up rooms in a hotel, excellently kept, though the building itself is bad, according to Lee, and made a preliminary investigation on foot of their immediate surroundings. Robert E. Lee was not impressed with St. Louis. "It is," he wrote, "the most expensive and the dirtiest place I was ever in. Our daily expenses about equal our daily pay." A week later, he complained to his wife, "It is astonishingly hot here, thermometer 97 degrees in the house. The dust is now only ankle deep in the streets, only ankle deep, but put in motion by the slightest wind, penetrates everywhere. The city's one saving grace, according to Lee, was its pretty girls, which he had yet to encounter, but knew must be somewhere in St. Louis." Lee was always commenting on the pretty girls. After 16 days in St. Louis, Lee and Meigs, along with a 14-man surveying party, headed upriver. 150 miles upstream at the Des Moines Rapids, the party attempted to pass in their steamer, Meigs wrote in the third person, and quickly experienced the difficulties of the navigation by finding themselves fast on the rocks. All efforts to float the steamer failed, and the party proceeded to make their survey of these rapids while using the steamer as a base of operations, the surveying parties leaving the steamer in small boats in the morning and returning at night. Their work involved collecting data at the rapids, sounding the water depth at various intervals, taking sightings for an accurate map, etc., so that the problem could be approached scientifically. Low water during 3 months of the year made passage of these rapids all but impossible. Lee planned to blast a permanent, year-long lasting channel through the white water. When not working, the engineers fished amongst the rocks and penned long letters home. They also admired the untouched, unimproved countryside. The land along the upper Mississippi had yet to be surveyed or brought into the market. When the party tired of living aboard the steamer, Lee quartered the men in an abandoned log cabin nearby. He and Meigs, meanwhile, quote, "took up our blankets and walked a short mile to a so-called city composed of the worst kind of a small log cabin which contained the proprietor and the entire population. Here we were kindly received and accommodated." Sounds a little crowded, doesn't it? His host, Lee wrote his wife, "the nabob of this section of the country, was a hard-featured man of about 50, a large talker, and has the title of doctor Whether of law, medicine, or science, I have never learned but infer all three. And some people say Robert E. Lee didn't have a sense of humor. This gentleman told Lee of his plans for a mill, a distillery, and a bridge spanning the Mississippi River. From the Des Moines Rapids, the party next proceeded another 100 miles upstream to the tail end of the Rock Island Rapids. There they discovered another steamer wrecked upon a rock, wrote Meigs. Lieutenant Lee made this wreck his base of operations during the survey of the upper rapids. About the end of October, the work on this part of the river was finished, and they returned to the Des Moines Rapids on a passing steamer. At these rapids, they found the banks lined with birch bark canoes and Indian teepees, a tribe of Chippewas having assembled there to receive the fall distribution of presents from the agents. Picking up their original steamboat there, the party rode the current back to St. Louis. The Lee Meg surveying party returned to the river town on October 8th. The surveys of the upper rapids had convinced Lee that channels could be cut through them without too much trouble. Now it was necessary to produce the requisite maps and write up the recommendations. It was also time to tackle the largest portion of Lee's assignment out west, the Mississippi at St. Louis. Therefore, after renting the second story of a warehouse as an office and turning over the map illustration to Meigs and Henry I. Kayser, a German-born cartographer, Lee focused his attention on saving the harbor. First, wrote Meigs, parties were placed in the field on each bank of the river. Signals were established, and the river was thoroughly triangulated and sounded from the mouth of the Missouri to some distance below St. Louis. Meigs makes the task sound simple, but he is referring here to at least 20 miles of the Mississippi River. With the harbor data thus collected, Lee devised a scheme to deepen the original channel in front of the city and wash away Duncan's Island. Based in part upon the investigations performed by Shreve and Gratiot, Lee presented his formal report on December 6, 1837. It was deceptively simple. From the Illinois bank of the Mississippi, a 600-yard long dam, so you might want to take a look at this. From the Illinois bank of the Mississippi, a 600-yard long dam, and that's AB there, or dike, would be laid to the head of Bloody Island. Hopefully, this structure would permanently divert the river to the Missouri side of the sandbar and eventually attach Bloody Island to the state of Illinois. The western face of the island below this dam was to be shielded by a stone revetment one-third of a mile long, and that's AC. See that dotted line? Additionally, at the foot of Bloody Island, another dam. This one at least 1,000 yards long, running parallel with the banks of the Mississippi, and that's ED, D-E, would be constructed to throw the full force of the river against the head of Duncan's Island. Lee admitted that the dams could only be built with great difficulty and estimated the total cost at $158,554. Kind of precise, huh? Sounds like Jefferson in that way. Lee's proposal, if it worked, would manhandle the Mississippi into its original channel by cutting off its alternate route east of Bloody Island and then use the river itself for the demise of Duncan's Island. Obviously, the construction of the two dams was crucial to the plan's success. For each, Lee proposed driving two parallel rows of pilings, 25 feet apart, into the riverbed. The space between them was to be filled with sand and small stones. On both of the outer faces, brush weighted down with rocks would be dumped into the water until it extended out a good 40 feet on either side. It was anticipated that sand and silt would soon thereafter fill in all the open spaces. Taking stock of the river's problems and putting together his report had consumed the balance of 1837. So, after preparing for the upcoming work season, including ordering four more flatboats, Lee and Meigs headed back east. Henry Kayser, the German mapmaker, would hold down the fort at St. Louis until Lee returned. The trip home to Arlington was memorable for Lee because it included a ride on the newly opened Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. It was Lee's first. In Washington, Lee and Meigs parted company. Although the two engineers would never again work together, Montgomery C. Meigs would later profoundly affect the Lee family. Robert E. Lee returned to St. Louis in May of 1838, this time with his wife and children in tow. After establishing his family in comfortable quarters, Lee went back to work. Within a couple of weeks, his new assistant, Lieutenant Horace Bliss, arrived from Louisville with a new flatboat, so Lee dispatched him to the Des Moines Rapids, along with a good-sized workforce. While Bliss concentrated on improving the channel upriver, first drilling into the rocks and then blasting them apart, Lee made war on the St. Louis sandbars. Because Congress had not appropriated enough funds for both of his proposed dams, Robert E. Lee decided to begin construction on the one he believed would most greatly affect Duncan's Island. In June, therefore, the dike facing the city, the one running from the foot of Bloody Island, was begun and within time stretched south for 2,500 feet. Naturally, the citizens of St. Louis were extremely interested in this project. Robert E. Lee was determined not to let them down. Lee went in person with the hands every morning about sunrise, St. Louis Mayor John F. Darby later wrote, and worked day by day in the hot, broiling sun, the heat being greatly increased by the reflection from the river. He shared in the hard task and common fare and rations furnished to the common laborers, something we saw during the Civil War too, eating at the same table in the cabin of the steamboat used in the persecution of the work. In this same place, in other words, in the cabin, Lieutenant Lee with his assistant, Henry Kayser, worked at his drawings, plans, and estimates every night until 11 o'clock. Lee's hard work paid off. With a stronger force of water beating against the head of Duncan's Island, its sand and silt began washing away. By the end of the construction season, wrote Freeman, 700 feet of the island had disappeared. Not only so, but the channel across the bar between Bloody Island and Duncan's Island had been deepened by 7 feet. When boats once more could reach the lower part of the city, there was as much rejoicing among the merchants as there was in the heart of the young engineer. The success was gratifying, but because another shoal was growing opposite the head of Bloody Island, this one on the Missouri side, Lee was convinced more than ever that the other dike, the other dam, was absolutely necessary. He decided, however, that his original plan would likely fail because it called for a structure perpendicular to the current of the river. Such a structure naturally would receive the most resistance from the Mississippi. Lee now proposed a longer dam, which would begin much farther upstream and descend to the head of Bloody Island at a sharp angle. This dam required a further appropriation from Congress. That august body adjourned in July without approving the needed funds, however, so the city of St. Louis advanced Robert E. Lee $15,000 for the continuation of his work. With General Grasshot's approval, the engineer began work on this slanting dam. From the Illinois shore, a steam-driven pile driver Lee had contracted began pounding the double rows of pilings into the Mississippi's soft riverbed. While at work on this part of the project, Lee received notice that he had been commissioned Captain of Engineers. In late December of 1838, Robert E. Lee received one of the worst shocks of his entire career. He learned that Charles Grasshot, his mentor, the St. Louis native who had strongly supported all of this work on the Mississippi, had been dismissed from the Army for refusing to account for certain public funds. "It came upon me like a thunderclap," Lee penned to Talcott. "And I was as little prepared for such an event as I would have been for the annihilation of the city of Washington by an earthquake." Grasshot's replacement was Colonel Joseph G. Totten, a competent engineer who nonetheless had no special commitment to Lee's project. Reeling from this unfortunate turn of events, Lee closed the year's work season without completing the second dam. Lee and the family were free to return to Virginia, but due to the arrival of winter, navigation on the rivers was closed. At St. Louis, they would have to remain. During Congress's winter short session, running from December 1838 to March 4, 1839, it was hoped that body would loosen its purse strings. To the contrary, however, responding to the government's dire financial straits, Congress not only refused additional funds for the Mississippi improvements, but called upon Lee to share the money from the previous year's appropriation. Along with losing half of his available monies, $20,000 went to Captain Shreve for removing snags on the Missouri River. Lee was advised by the Corps that, quote, "under the present state of affairs, you should not be involved in the details of these civil works more than is absolutely necessary," unquote. If that was not enough, Wife Mary was pregnant again and needed to be escorted back to Arlington. Leaving on May 1st, Lee made the trip home in an amazing 11 days. He was back in St. Louis by mid-June. Although his project was underfunded, Lee was determined to forge ahead. The first order of business was getting Lieutenant Bliss back to work at the Des Moines Rapids. The lack of funds dictated that he attack only one of the two upriver torrents. The weather was fairly mild, however, and more importantly, the water was low, a good time to start work. Under Lee's instructions, a narrow 30-foot channel of the river at the tail end of the rapids was widened to over 50 feet. Difficult twists and turns through the rocks were straightened. At another location, a large reef that dominated the river was removed in its entirety. By the fall of 1839, Lee estimated that close to 2,000 tons of stone had been raised out of the river at the Des Moines Rapids. Considering the lack of resources, he rated it a tolerable season's work. Back in St. Louis, Lee renewed his work on the second dam, the one he had begun from the Illinois bank on August 12th. To bolster his coffers, he sold off the extra equipment that he now could not afford to man anyway. And there was yet another change. Under orders from Colonel Totten, the new chief engineer, Lee had to revert to his original plan for this dike. He was now to construct a shorter dam, one that projected into the water perpendicularly. Work proceeded apace for 2 weeks until a second Illinois circuit judge had it halted on August 27th. Lee had in hand what seemed all the proper permits, but he had not approached the owners of the Illinois town of Brooklyn, and you can see it on this little map, just upriver from where he was working, which at the time, Brooklyn at the time, existed only on paper. So obviously you could avoid a place that really existed only on paper. It'd be easy to overlook a place like that. Upset that Lee's work would create a sandbar at the site and thus reduce its value, a man by the name of Morris had asked for the injunction. Listen to this. If the work was not terminated on this dam, the state of Illinois would send an officer to arrest Robert E. Lee as well as several other men under the charge of, quote-unquote, obstructing a navigable river. We can only imagine Lee's reaction to this suit, which in public he referred to as fallacious. But the sad truth was that it would not be resolved prior to the court's regular term in February of 1840. The work on the river at St. Louis, therefore, came to a grinding halt. The situation there had improved, however, at least enough to give Lee a bit of satisfaction. The dam at Bloody Island's tail end was still standing and doing its job. Another large portion of Duncan's Island had been washed away. The second dam, though uncompleted, was nonetheless diverting the current back into its old channel. Steamboats again had a straight course down the river to the wharves at St. Louis. After a brief tour of duty inspecting the other improvements on the Mississippi River as well as those on the Ohio and the Missouri, Lee returned to Arlington in December 1839. After 4 months of leave, Lee was reassigned temporarily to the chief engineer's office in Washington. Robert E. Lee was ordered back to St. Louis in the summer of 1840. An inspection of the harbor showed that his improvements were still operating. The channel between Bloody Island and what was left of Duncan's Island was now deep enough to accommodate the Mississippi's largest steamboats. Upriver at the Des Moines Rapids, the passageways cut in 1839 had facilitated navigation and were now being used exclusively. More efforts were required, however, at both of these locations. No more federal funds were available, though. So Lee's work on the Mississippi River was done. Further improvements at St. Louis would henceforth be the province of the state of Missouri and the city itself. Lee expressed to me his chagrin and mortification, wrote Mayor Darby, at being compelled to discontinue the work. It seemed as if it were a great personal misfortune to stop when the work was about half finished. Lee departed St. Louis, never to return, in October of 1840. Henry Kaiser, Lee's civilian assistant, picked up where the Virginian had left off. Appointed city engineer of St. Louis, Kaiser, in continuous communication with Robert E. Lee, completed the harbor projects devised by Lee in 1856, 16 years later, at the cost of an additional $175,000. Duncan's Island was completely washed away. Bloody Island eventually attached itself to Illinois and became a part of East St. Louis. The Mississippi Project was Robert E. Lee's first independent assignment. It developed his ingenuity and greatly reinforced his conviction that the scientific approach to a problem, the collection and careful study of all the data available, was an engineer's first responsibility. It also established his standing in the Army Corps of Engineers. Difficult problems had been assigned him, and despite the eventual evaporation of funds for the project, he had tackled them brilliantly. According to Freeman, the opportunities that were to come to him in Mexico were created at St. Louis. Mayor Darby of St. Louis never forgot Robert E. Lee. By his rich gift of genius and scientific knowledge, he wrote years later in his autobiography, "Lieutenant Lee brought the father of waters under control. I made known to Robert E. Lee in appropriate terms the great obligations the authorities and citizens generally were under to him for his skill and labor in preserving the harbor. One of the most gifted and cultivated minds I had ever met with, he was scrupulously conscientious and faithful in the discharge of his duties as he was modest and unpretending. The labors of Robert E. Lee can speak for themselves." That was Mayor Darby. What a great recommendation. In writing this piece, the author was reminded of a fictitious 20th century hero who could supposedly change the course of mighty rivers. Robert E. Lee actually did. As previously mentioned, Lee and Meigs never again worked together. Although a Southerner by birth, Meigs sided with the North during the Civil War and served ably as the Union Army's quartermaster general. As the conflict dragged on and the casualty list lengthened, Meigs felt more and more animosity toward the Confederate leadership. In June of 1864, when asked to recommend a site for a national cemetery, Meigs chose Arlington, Robert E. Lee's home. Union soldiers were interred at Lee's very doorstep shortly thereafter. 20 years later, however, when Armistead Lindsey Long, living in Charlottesville, was compiling information for his Memoirs of Robert E. Lee, Meigs was able to recall the warm friendship he and Lee had enjoyed out west on the mighty Mississippi. "Lee," Meigs wrote to Long, "was a man then in the vigor of youthful strength, with a noble and commanding presence and an admirable, graceful, and athletic figure. He was one with whom nobody ever wished or ventured to take a liberty, though kind and generous to his subordinates, admired by all women, and respected by all men. He was the model of a soldier and the beau ideal of a Christian man. Time truly heals all wounds." Thank you. Andy. Frank was telling me about this. Evidently, there is a Robert E. Lee Avenue or a boulevard, but it's not in one of the better parts of town anymore. I think they did name, you know, one of the streets after him. I think that's about it. But there's no mention on the arch, right? Wow. Two and a half years. Yeah. Yes, sir. Well, you know, I just found this in a book on engineering, and it could be that the guy went around and painted all the places the same. But one thing, and I forgot to tell you about this, one thing, you might notice that on the right of the painting, it shows an island. That might be the tail end of Bloody Island right there. You see it? It looks like that barge is headed right up into it. That might be it right there. But you could be right. I don't know. You could be right. So somebody back here had a question? Yes, sir.
Richard was talking about New York, and I wondered if it would take you too far off your trip to talk about Lee and Fort Howard.
Yeah, his next assignment was at Fort Hamilton in New York, and he was there from 41 to 46. The reason I left that out, I wanted to focus on the Mississippi, and I thought that his work there meant more to him because it was independent, an independent assignment. And so that's why I focused on that. Really, I know very little about his work. Do you? I know very little. I'm sorry. But I would imagine it would be very similar to his work at Fortress Monroe, where he was improving a fortification that had already been begun years earlier. And really, at Fort Pulaski, he was there at the very beginning in the Savannah River, and it wasn't until 15 years later. So I don't know if they mentioned him at Fort Pulaski as being one of the early engineers. There was a question over here. That's a really good question. Although you'd have to argue that the Mississippi was important, to the entire continent. But one of the things I should probably add something about this is that they had just established an arsenal at St. Louis. So if the harbor was sealed off, it would have affected the Army's use of that arsenal. But also, because it was in the middle of the Mississippi, Bloody Island was it. It really came under no jurisdiction, and that was the problem. It kind of became the province of the federal government because it was in the middle of this river. Missouri wasn't going to do anything about it by itself. Eventually they did when they saw that something could be done, and Illinois up to that time had done nothing about the problem. So it kind of became a federal problem because of that. But you could argue that transportation on a river like the Mississippi was something that was very important to the Army. Right, right. 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 And this, and another part that I left out of the article, this was at the very beginning of appropriations, large appropriations like these for internal improvements. At the very beginning of that. Of course, then it dried up because of the government situation. Yes, sir. The Army Corps of Engineers, yes, sir. Yes, sir, the Army Corps of Engineers is still. Yep, it sure is. Just after Robert E. Lee left, they established yet another type of Army engineer, and that is the topographical engineers. And later, work on the Mississippi came under the aegis of the Army topographical engineers. At the time, though, they were graduating one kind of generic engineer. And the country was lucky because really it was I think at the time there was only one other, when Robert E. Lee graduated, there was only one other engineering school in the United States. And West Point was older. I can't remember the name of the other school right now. Do you remember? Yeah, Rensselaer, yes, sir. Absolutely, absolutely. That's it. Any other questions? Good questions. Yeah, Frank. Mm-hmm. Frank was asking about Colonel Totten and wanted to know if Lee had a good relationship. Eventually he did. And one of the things that shows up in the Civil War about Robert E. Lee could have a good relationship with anybody. And it was one of the reasons he advanced so much is he always got along well with his superiors. So eventually Robert E. Lee and Totten did get along really well. But this was at the beginning of the relationship. So to him it was just a catastrophe that Gratiot, a native of St. Louis, had been removed. It was a big blow. And perhaps he would have fought for the appropriations with his friends in the government. Yeah, Keith. Many years later. No, I didn't, but most of my sources, aside from Freeman, which I still think is the best biography, most of my sources were those put together by the engineers, and so they were talking about the project itself and very little External data. Yeah, but that would have been, I would have liked to have included that. No, I didn't come across that. Well, he was no longer serving as an engineer in Texas. He was a lieutenant colonel of what was it, the 2nd Dragoons? 2nd Dragoons in Texas. So he no longer had the title of an engineer. Any other questions? Y'all asked some great ones. Okay, thank you very much.